All right, well, moving right along, let's move into item 10, which is going to be an educational presentation on the Ralph M. Brown Act, our favorite act, the open meeting laws. And I'm going to turn it over to Karen. There she is. So you just moved on my screen. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. This is an education regarding the Brown Act. If I could have our staff put up the slides. The slides are included in the agenda packet. Let's go to slide number 2 and cover the basics, which are that the Brown Act applies to the SACERA Board of Retirement as it does to other local legislative bodies in California. And it gives us the laws regarding how to conduct the board's meetings. The key concepts behind the Brown Act are that the retirement board meetings have to be open and accessible to the public, that a meeting agenda has to be posted publicly, and during board meetings, the public must be given an opportunity to comment. Next slide, please. Meetings are defined as a congregation of a majority of the retirement board to hear, discuss, deliberate, or take action on items within the board's jurisdiction. Next slide. Here we address serial meetings. Those also count as meetings under the Brown Act, and so the same rules apply to those. And so serial meetings are what occurs if there is a serial use of communication, and it could be speaking or using email, using technology to discuss an item within the board's jurisdiction. And an example of an unlawful serial meeting is one where it is not happening during a board meeting that is noticed and open to the public. But instead, the example here on this slide is Trustee A emails Trustee B about a retirement board issue. B forwards the email to C, and C forwards it to D, who then forwards it to E. Now you have 5 board members in a string of emails essentially discussing an issue that should be discussed during an open and noticed public meeting. And so that type of serial meeting or serial communication is unlawful. It should not happen this way. A mere series of emails or phone calls by a majority of the trustees about a business item of SACERA would violate the Brown Act. Next slide. The Brown Act also applies to committee meetings. And so to the extent that there are standing committees of the board, for example, for SACERA, there is a audit committee, and that is a standing committee. The Brown Act rules apply to its meetings. There is an exception, though, if there is a committee that is temporary, an advisory committee that's convened for a limited purpose and for a limited duration, that is not subject to the Brown Act. And so that does not have to occur during a public and properly noticed meeting. Next slide, please.
Karen, if we establish an ad hoc committee, for instance, to look into a specific matter or task it, you know, with X, Y, and Z, you know, to do, but it's not a standing committee, then that committee's work is not subject to the Brown Act, right?
Correct.
Okay.
So next, we address a couple of exceptions that are built into the Brown Act, where the board is allowed to have more than a quorum attend, but there are restrictions. One of them is an attendance at conferences, but only if the conference is open to the public. If the conference is open to the public, we can have more than 5 board members attend, but they have to be careful not to discuss among themselves a business item that is within the subject matter jurisdiction of the retirement board. So examples of these conferences will be your SACRS and CALIPERS conferences, again, so long as they are open to the public. Next slide. Another exception is attendance at a purely social event, for example, a wedding. The board could have more than five board members there, more than a quorum. However, they have to be careful not to discuss CICERA business. Next. Social media, that was added a number of years ago to clarify that participation in social media by the board members is allowed if you get into a situation where there's a dialogue there on social media. You have to be careful again not to discuss among the board members CICERA business items. Next slide. One of the key requirements in the Brown Act is for there to be an agenda. That is the way we notify the public what the board is going to be discussing, when and where. And that has to be made available at least 72 hours before a regular board meeting. Next. And the agenda requirement means that if an item is not included on the agenda, the board may not act or discuss that item, but there are a few limited exceptions. The board is allowed to ask questions for clarification or make brief announcements or make a brief report. And the key there is that it needs to be brief. So you may make those announcements, reports, or ask for clarification of items that are not on the agenda. Next slide. Also, to the extent that there's something that came up that is urgent that needs to be discussed, but it's not on the agenda, the board, the Brown Act does allow the board to discuss and even take action on the item, but there are conditions that have to be met. The board has to determine by a two-thirds vote that there is a need to take immediate action and that the need for the action came to the attention of CICERA subsequent to the agenda being posted. If those conditions are met, then the board can proceed to discuss and take action on that item, although it is not on the agenda. Next slide, please. The Brown Act does require that the board publicly report any action taken and the vote or abstention of each member present for the action. Next slide, please. Public comment must be allowed, and the Brown Act does state that the board may apply reasonable time limits for public comments being made. Next. The Brown Act also addresses disruptive attendees and allows the board to handle those if the meeting is willfully interrupted. The board may clear the room of the disruptive individuals and continue the meeting. And a new requirement is that there must be a warning to the disruptor prior to having them removed from the room. Next. So up until now, we've been talking about open meetings, notice to the public, opportunity for the public to make comment. Now we'll discuss closed session. The Brown Act does allow closed sessions, meaning that the public is excluded from the discussion, but that is only allowed for enumerated circumstances. Examples include matters that are under litigation, whether it's pending litigation or anticipated litigation, or if the board is meeting to decide whether to initiate litigation. Additionally, when it comes to a public pension fund, the purchase or sale of a particular specific pension fund investment may be done in closed session as well. Also, personnel matters, including disability applications, may be done in closed session. Next. Additional examples include closed sessions for the board to confer with CICERA's designated representatives regarding employees' salaries and benefits, but there is a prohibition against taking final action in closed session. That final action on salaries and benefits has to happen in open session. And another example is that the board may meet in closed session to evaluate the performance of public employees. And the agenda in that case must disclose the title of the employee or employees that are being discussed. And again, the closed session must not include a discussion or action on proposed compensation. Those types of discussions cannot occur within a performance evaluation closed session. Next. After a closed session, there needs to be a public report made to the public. The Brown Act does specify that what types of reports need to occur depending on the subject matter. And public reports, for example, of pension fund investment transactions do not have to be disclosed to the public until after the close of that transaction. The board does, to the extent that there is a vote in closed session and that item needs to be disclosed to the public, then there needs to be a disclosure of each board member's vote on the matter. Next slide, please. Board members may not disclose confidential information acquired by being present in a closed session to a person not entitled to receive that information. Next. All right, now we turn to teleconferencing, which is what the board is doing today. We're teleconferencing. There are now several options for teleconferencing. Basically, as you may recall from before the COVID-19 pandemic, there was always a traditional rule in the Brown Act that allowed teleconferencing. However, in March of 2020, with the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic and the state of emergency declaration, the governor issued executive orders that temporarily modified the Brown Act and allowed a complete virtual meeting like what we are having today. Subsequently to that, in September of 2021, the executive orders expired, but another change in the law occurred, AB 361, and that continued to allow teleconferencing with some conditions that had to be met. The manner in which the board is conducting the meeting today is in compliance with AB 361. And that is effective through the end of this year. That's sort of a second way of teleconferencing besides the traditional rules. And a third teleconferencing option was added recently by the legislature, and we did discuss it in detail in December when we discussed new legislation. And that allows a teleconferencing for just cause or with an emergency circumstance, but a quorum of the board has to be physically present. I'll talk in a few minutes about what the just cause and emergency circumstance conditions meet. Next slide, please. So again, three options for teleconference: the traditional teleconferencing rules that have been in effect throughout the pandemic, before the pandemic, and today and in the future, the AB 361 teleconference rules, which is what we're utilizing today, and the new teleconference rules regarding just cause and emergency circumstances. Next, please. All right, we're on slide 21. In the traditional teleconference rules, what those require is we have to have at least a quorum, five trustees in our physical location within Contra Costa County. All votes taken have to be taken by roll call. The agenda has to be posted at all teleconference locations. Each teleconference location must be identified in the agenda. Each teleconference location must be accessible to the public, and The agenda must provide for public comment at each teleconference location. So if you're teleconferencing in from Oregon, then that teleconference location has to be made available to the public so that they can come and make public comment in that location. Again, this is the traditional teleconference rules. Next slide, please. Meeting under AB 361, again, that's what we're doing today, also has some conditions that have to be met. And I'll highlight, I won't go over each one of them, but I'll highlight the fact that this one requires a reconsideration every 30 days. And so this is why every 30 days, the board has had an item on the agenda to consider this, the emergency situation, and decide, are we continuing to meet virtually or not? And in fact, today, later on the agenda, there is just that item again for the board's consideration. Let's go to slide 25, please. And this is the new law under AB 2449. And again, this is a third way of teleconferencing. It also requires a quorum of the trustees being in person in a single location, just like the traditional teleconferencing rules. Board members can teleconference only if they have a just cause or an emergency circumstance. And if teleconferencing, the board member who's appearing remotely, they must participate through both audio and visual technology. So the public should be able to hear them and see them from wherever they're calling. Another interesting requirement is that board member who's appearing that way remotely has to publicly disclose at the meeting before any action is taken whether any other individual 18 years of age or older are present in the room at the remote location with a member, and the general nature of the member's relationship with any such individual. Next, please. We're on slide 26. One important condition is that in order to invoke this type of teleconferencing, the agency must provide the public either a two-way audio-visual platform. So an example of that would be Zoom, which is what we're using today, or a two-way telephonic service and a live webcasting of the meeting. Okay, let's go to slide 27, please. Just cause under this option is defined as follows. A child care or caregiving need of a child, parent, so forth. A contagious illness that prevents the trustee from attending in person. A need related to a physical or mental disability. Or travel while on official business of the board's agency or another state or local agency. Next slide, please. 28. A board member who intends to participate via teleconference has to notify the board of that possibility, and that notification can be done the morning of at the start of the regular board meeting, and they have to notify that they have a need to participate remotely for just cause and provide a general description of the circumstances relating to their need. And there is a restriction there where board members are not allowed to participate this way for just cause for more than two meetings in a calendar year. Next slide, please, number 29. Now we look at the definition of the emergency circumstance, and that is defined as a physical or family medical emergency that prevents a member from attending in person. And to appear that way, the board member has to request the board to allow them to participate remotely due to the emergency, and the board has to take action to approve that request. Next slide, please. Number 30. So these teleconferencing rules may not be invoked by any board member for more than 3 consecutive months or 20% of the regular meetings of the board within a calendar year if the board meets at least 10 times per calendar year. And that's in addition to the limitation I just mentioned on just cause appearance, because that is limited to no more than 2 meetings per calendar year. And this particular law sunsets in 2026. So it gives agencies a couple of years to work within these rules. Next slide, please. And before I go into the consequences of violating the Brown Act, let me pause and see if there's any questions.
I don't have a question, but I just wanted to, and maybe this is a spoiler alert, but in terms of us returning to the boardroom, which we anticipate to be, I think, for March 8th, if I've got the calendar in mind right, we are not going to be conducting teleconference proceedings. That is, we're going to be meeting in person, and not because we're not set up in terms of audio visual to provide that opportunity. So at least for the present and foreseeable future, a board member who needs to appear from a remote location for whatever reason would be under the conference call rule as opposed to the teleconferencing. I think I'm correct. I guess I should put that in the form of a question, Karen, to you. I think what I just said is accurate, but I want to confirm that.
Yes, the board has indicated a desire to resume in-person meetings in March, and there will be an agenda item later today addressing that. And once the board returns to in-person meetings, the traditional teleconference rules will apply, meaning that I'm not going to go over all the details, but you can be in a different location and teleconference in, but you have to open up that location to the public. But in terms of the newest law of, you know, allowing remote appearances for just cause or emergency circumstances, that does require the boardroom to be set up in a certain way to allow the audio visual to occur. And that's not currently the case. And so we wouldn't be able to use it.
Correct. Thank you. I appreciate the clarification. That's what I thought. Mike, you had your hand up.
Yeah, Karen, on page 25 at the bottom, you talk about when you're teleconferencing, you have to identify people 18 years of old or older that are in the room and their relationship. Do you know the reasoning for that, or what the why that came about?
I don't have any insight into why that requirement was added. I can only imagine that folks wanted transparency. And so if someone else is in the room, there's a desire, I suppose, on the part of the legislature that there would be a public disclosure of that fact and identify who that person is and why they're there.
Yeah, I'm thinking, Mike, that lobbyist types would have been the target of that. And I don't mean to pick on lobbyists, but in the sense of if someone is traveling with a lobbyist or someone who's got a contract with the agency or whatever, I think that would speak volumes. So the disclosure rule would be a disincentive to do that. I think that's how I would say it.
Any other questions before we move on? Let's go back to page 31 and the consequences of violating the Brown Act, criminal liability, civil remedies, and the most common of that is basically to invalidate the action that was taken to the extent it was done in violation of the Brown Act. And the plaintiff or claimant who files an action and it succeeds, and the court agrees that the agency violated the Brown Act, may be awarded their attorney fees and costs. last slide, and that is for questions, and I'm happy to entertain any.
Questions for Karen on the Brown Act. Appears not. I think we covered all of the basics. John, I'm sorry, you had your hand up. I apologize.
Yes, a quick question. Has anybody, Karen, to your knowledge, ever been held criminally liable and presumably subject to jail time and et cetera for a Brown Act violation?
I would have to research that.
You're not aware of any.
No.
That's probably, you don't need to research it.
I'm not either. None are coming to mind. Offhand, John, even in any one-off high profile cases, I can't think of one. And I can't remember if it was on the slide or not, but one of the fundamental things in the remedies under the Brown Act is that the primary remedy, and Karen, I'm going to paraphrase you, correct me if I get this wrong, is do-over. So for instance, if you incorrectly take an action or didn't follow the procedural requirements or what have you, it doesn't just invalidate the action for all time and it's go back to zero and you're done. It's the entity can do it over and do it properly, and that cures the violation. And so that's the most common thing, John, is for a curative remedy of do-over. As I say, I just can't think offhand of any criminal case that's come about. There might be criminal cases or matters that have been prosecuted that relate more to government code section 1090 or self-dealing and that kind of stuff. But I can't think of any under the Brown Act per se.
Okay.
I don't know. Other questions for Karen? I'm not seeing any, so you dazzled them, Karen, so thank you.
Well, thank you, and that concludes my presentation.
Excellent. Thank you very much.